session number 10671, reel 2.
Now back to reel 2.
Well, you had to enter to produce entertainment yourselves, and that meant that you had to run concert parties and the like. There was no nearest thing you got to cinema. An occasional travelling cinema came around where you set up, and the most extraordinary thing, looking back on it now, out in the wide open spaces where you might be confronted with a sandstorm suddenly, and you used to try and produce a film, which is some very old film and so on. For the rest, we had to provide our own entertainment. One of the first jobs I was given was to do exactly that, to produce some form of concert party and all the rest from the town. It was an interesting job, quite hard work. And looking back, it's extraordinary how much talent you can find in a British battalion in the way of various instruments they can play, of people who have a definite stage presence, who are mimics and so on. But it took quite a lot of organizing, and I got, in, as always one does as a young officer, into trouble to a certain extent because I was told that I was doing too much of this and not learning my job as a soldier and an officer. And it was not easy to strike a balance. I got into terrible trouble at times because I was told I was spending far too much time on this. Whereas I thought I was doing my stuff.
Did you adjust?
Oh, well, you jolly well have to, yes, quickly. Yeah. You see, one thing was that my British CEO of the Foresters reported to my father that he was a little worried about me because I was spending too much time on this. And they meant that the two of them had a row because my father turned around and said, you asked me to do a job, now he started doing a job, now you turn around and saying he's doing too much of it. And my father made the famous remark in my family is, I'm not having my son turned into a bum-faced actor. And that has lasted throughout the family for the rest of time, you might say.
How were very junior officers like yourself with the Sherwood Foresters treated in the mess by the senior officers? Because one reads in books like Graves's book, Goodbye to All That, in his regiment, they were treated with a certain amount of, very slightingly. Was there anything of that from
you? No, I'd say the whole thing about it, as a young officer looking back on it, this is where we were taught as Sanderson certain things, towards the right to the end of the course, was, for goodness sake, keep your eyes and your ears wide open, but keep your mouth shut for at least the first 6 months and listen to exactly what goes on. I always remember another remark that comes back to me before one left Sandhurst, which proved very right, actually, and that is they were trying to give the officer in charge running this last session before we left Sandhurst, which was based upon how to behave in your first few days in an officer's mess. Now, this really was invaluable. And I always remember him saying, if you are in the mess yourself, by yourself one day, and somebody walks in civilian dress, as occasionally can happen, not so much in India perhaps, the first thing you do is you'll jump to your feet and you say, good morning, sir, and you offer him a cigarette, and it must be out for a cigarette case, no packet, says the instructor. And he says, no, thank you very much, I don't smoke. And you turn around and say, now then, and what can I offer you to drink, sir? Would you have whiskey, gin? If he says no again, treat him with the greatest reserve and suspicion. Absolutely true. And that was one's whole attitude. We didn't think it was particularly funny. We thought, how wise. Now we know how to behave. Now, another trouble, if I may say so at that time, it comes to mind, was how badly we were paid as an officer. As an officer, I know everything is relative in the state of money today. One's paid as a second lieutenant the magnificent sum of 9 and 6 pence a day. The actual standard mess charge for our food in the mess, and it varied from British battalion to British battalion, the foresters had a very high standard of food, a little cold side on, you know, cold board and all the rest of it. The actual messing per day would be 7 and 6p. One was left with the magnificent sum of 2 shillings, and when one was then told that you had to join the club and join various other things, you had to hire a bicycle, pay for a bear, and so on, and so inevitably, it was without overindulgence, you couldn't possibly not be in debt, unless you had private means. And let us face it, that a very fair proportion of the forestry officers did have private means. But those of us who come from the ULI for the future Indian Army, I hardly remember anyone who had any private means at all.
Was your personal appearance as a young officer dictated by the regiment in terms of whether you had moustaches or...
No, I wouldn't say that. But the sort of thing was that you had to, your uniform had to be exactly, in though it was khaki drill, your uniform had to be exactly to the regimental pattern of your regiment. Now, it did vary. For instance, when I first went out to India, I got a complete set of the kit that was considered required for use in India, whether you went to a British battalion, whatever it was, from your military tailors in London, which is a company called Flights, which has simply gone bust now. Now, your khaki jackets, your drill jackets, went out there. They weren't cheap, bought in this country, made to measure, of course, and so on. When it got out there, the forester said, oh, no, that style's all wrong. You must not have a seam down the centre of the back. We have never had a seam down the centre of your back of your jacket. You won't have one now. So you had to throw all that away and to get the forester pattern with a seam coming down the side there. This is the sort of thing that you had to watch.
So that clothing was wasted?
That clothing was basically wasted, unless it matched up to your future in battalion. Usually it did, because they weren't so fussy. But as regards... of course, there's no question of wearing a beard. I mean, that never came into it. Whether you had a moustache or not was entirely your business.
But you are expected to behave in a manly way and to pursue manly pursuits.
Oh, indeed. Yes. You were expected to join the club and play any tennis or all the sort of social things you had then, and play... Well, hockey and that sort of thing. Not very many of us played football. This is one of the troubles, because as you know, there's one's background. There are very few public schools in those days that played soccer. They all played rugger. And though the foresters did have a rugger side, which in fact I did play for, but the trouble was that down on the plains, playing rugger was quite impossible from a heat point of view, from the hardness of the ground, and so on. So the only time you played rugger was when you went up to the hills. We went up to Dalhousie for 3 months of the hot weather. And at a height of 7,000 feet, when we played rugger there, you had to play... I've never done it before, and I never want to do it again. You played rugger before breakfast, and starting at about 6:30, 6:45, in order to get the coolness. And you had to have a break every 15 minutes because of the rarity, the atmosphere, and so on, at 7,000 feet, you really couldn't go on for more than 15 minutes of a game like that. The ground was still distinctly hard, I can tell you, even up there. So you carried on, yes, your normal life.
Can we go on to your transfer to the Punjab Regiment?
Yes.
And can you tell me what kind of reception you had from the First Aid? When you went there?
Yes, well, I was with the foresters in Bombay, and then I had to move from the foresters in Bombay up to Hong Kong, which, when you think of how long it takes these days, a matter of hours, or when I had to do it in 1933, going to Calcutta and catching a boat, which went to Rangoon, to Singapore, and all the way up the coast, it took something like 3 weeks to get from Bombay to Hong Kong, which is what we did. Anyway, when I got there, I was a little apprehensive, needless to say, with what reception I'd get, because of my father being my CO, and my mother, and so on. And it became very much a family concern because the adjutant was married to my cousin. So you can see there was very much a family element in there. And Walter Walker's brother was an officer in this battalion. So it was very much a family concern, and I had, I think, the good sense, even at the age of 20 as I was then, just to watch my stuff very carefully. And one of the problems was, in those days, we had very, very, very few officers, British officers. You never seen more than about five or six at a time in an active battalion, because you had to allow for two or three being on courses or on leave and so on, which meant that I had to solemnly live in the officer's mess by myself, with the whole staff waiting. All the rest were married. They were out in their various flats and wherever they lived. And one of the most extraordinary things I remember was it was decided that we had a very good regimental band, brass band, 42 strong, which is a matter of interest played in the Empire Exhibition at Wembley in 1926 as a band for the Indian Army. That used to have to turn out once a month just for me. The whole band played outside while I sat at the end of the table in all my regalia, passing the port and Madeira to myself, standing up and wishing His Majesty all the very best, all by myself. This is a sort of attitude you've got to sort of get used to. Struck me strange to begin with, but I got very used to it. The other thing was, what one had to be awfully careful. I couldn't help knowing that my father was inevitably having rows with certain other officers, or it's a big difference of opinion. So I knew I didn't particularly want it. I just happened to hear it, overhear it. I had to be very careful about what I said or what I knew or what I didn't know, and be very careful at any remark I made in the officer's mess, which might show that I had inside information about a particular officer being in trouble, as an example.
What was it like being stationed in Hong Kong in those days?
Oh, it was absolute fairyland. Of course, it wouldn't have done the Walter Walkers of this world any good, because for professionally it was a very bad station. When I think that in those days, A, they were very short of money, inevitably, for training and so on. We had a whole holiday on Wednesdays, Saturdays and Sundays, 3 days a week. And I was once deciding to walk up to do some work in the lines, we call it, in the barracks. And an officer turned around and said, "And what are you doing here now?" I said, "Well, I'm just going to check." And I was then told, "You don't come and worry the men on a holiday." So I said, "Well, goodness sake, if this is the way, this suits me." And so for the rest of the time, 3 days a week were holidays. For the rest of the week, all we had to parade ground, we had an Indian Army battalion, is a strong battalion, it's over 900 strong. We had the equivalent of one hockey pitch in which the whole battalion had to train. That was your signalers, your gunners, your machine gunners, your drill going on and so on. I mean, how much training can you do? And just for a fortnight a year, round about Christmas, we had the sort of, you might say, that the yearly manoeuvres, when we went out to the new territories with all the British battalion and the other Indian battalions and so on. And this is where we did a training. But that was only for a fortnight a year. The reason being, we were told there was just no money. There was no money and there was not much room.
Did you have to be careful with the troops regarding what they did in their free time?
That's a very difficult, of course, a very good question. And I think it is really rather remarkable. There were troops who were going to be out of India for 3 years without their families, no families allowed. And I remember my father saying one of the most difficult points is he was allowed 6 welfare passages per year for Indian troops to go back to visit their homeland and their homes and so on. And he used to say it is really one of the most difficult decisions they have to make is to choose those 6. You get some who are just as hardly done by as others. Now, faced with that, how to entertain Indian troops. The point was, of course, it's the usual business of trying to keep the rate of VD down, and our VD rate was remarkably small. When you think that an Indian armour, you know, they call them Indian armour, say the serpent type and all the rest of it, would jump over the wall of the barracks, and we prove that, and provide entertainment for an Indian troop for an all-round cost of threepence. You couldn't really parade all around the walls and all the rest of it. But it is quite remarkable how very low, or a low rate, it is a very high standard of discipline. There's no question about it.
What does the word armour mean, then?
Well, an armour is a Chinese serpent, basically, an armour car. It comes from, like an Indian, you have an ayah, don't you? You know that. It is the equivalent of an ayah, though armour is more broad. An ayah, of course, in India means really basically looking after children, whereas an armour is any of the servant class. She may be a cook, she may be a washerwoman, all the rest of it, generally speaking, is known as an armour.
Can you tell me now about the composition of the 1st 8th Punjab Regiment, in terms of where the troops came from and their religious background?
Yes. Well, the 1st 8th Punjab Regiment in those days consisted of two companies of Punjabi Musalman who came from the Salt Ranges, which is a range of hills in northern Punjab. All of them came from that area. We had very, very few Pathans. Then there was one company of Sikhs and one company of Gujars. Now, Gujar is a caste, a type of Hindu, who basically is recruited from the Delhi area. Now, that was considered a good mixture. The point, of course, of not having all one class battalions was the question of going back to, really, back to the Indian Mutiny. If you have all Muslims, or particularly if you have all Sikhs or Hindus, it is very difficult to know if you've got cliques, if you've got cells, if you've got potential danger spots, what is going on. If you have a mixture such as that, you always get an element, whether you think it's right or not, of one element splitting on the other. You'll get to know of it. And that really was the basic reason for it. Later on, we had to get rid of Sikhs. Sikhs are very brave fighters and so on. But you will never find out if there's trouble going on in the Sikh company. You'll never get to the bottom of it. And we used to say in the Indian Army, anybody who could really command a company of Sikhs could have no difficulty commanding an army division. It was an extremely difficult thing to do, to get to the bottom. And Sikhs were the ones who did, let's face it, they gave trouble in the war. Because of that, they're extremely brave, but they are a very tightly knit community, and one will not split on the other, irrespective of any wrongdoing or anything like that.
Even more so than Muslims.
Oh yes, oh yes, yes. It is an extremely tight, difficult community to deal with.
How did the Pathans fit in?
Well, we had very few Pathans. Punjabi Muslims, just a few had infiltrated. They were just mixed in with the rest, but they were all PMs, as we call them.
Was there much problem with feeding them regarding their religious prohibitions?
Do you mean in Hong Kong? Or do you mean anywhere?
Generally.
No. I would say that there are absolutely none, because we knew from generations what they ate, or what the various castes and that sort of thing did eat. But there were some very, for instance, World War I, there were some very high-grade Hindus that we had to get rid of. We couldn't recruit them anymore in the Indian Army, because for the simple reason that when rations were short and all the rest of it, if a British officer, when they were cooking outside, if his shadow fell over that food, then that food had to be destroyed, irrespective of how short rations were and so on. And you couldn't possibly have that set up going on in operations or at any time.
But you used a halal butcher, did you, for the...
Yes, you got the different types of a butcher for Hindus and again for Muslims. And they have, of course, all their own cooks. You must remember that each company had its own cooks and had its own religious personality. You had your religious leaders, you had to have your Muslim, you had to have your if you had Sikhs, your Granth, as it was known, and then you had to have your Hindu priest. And you were jolly careful not to do anything which was going to break across that. That was one of the things you really had to learn as a young officer. What you did, what you said as regards religion and any sort of study initially was on the question of learning what the pitfalls were, if you like, of dealing with Sikhs and Muslims and so on.
Did you ever have any officers who either deliberately or inadvertently infringed their religious...
You mean British officers? I honestly can't remember any case at all. The sort of thing you'd have to be careful of was, of course, Muslims don't drink any alcohol, and Sikhs do. And if at a party you'd get a... You occasionally get... you get whether the Viceroy's Commission officers with Sikhs and Hindus and so on together. And you might get... I only don't remember, comes back to memory now, one officer... during a party, let's face it, and trying to tease a Muslim into having a whiskey and soda to drink somebody's health. Now that, you see, is asking for trouble. You're asking for trouble. Now it is spotted, luckily, by a senior officer and pounced on, good and hearty. That is the sort of thing that can create problems. He meant it with the best will in the world, you know, join the party and we're all, don't worry, and what does one whiskey and soda make any difference and so on? It does.
So you had mullahs, did you, in the
yes,
battalion?
Yes, we wouldn't like to call them mullahs. We mullahs, you see, to us are the Khomeinis of today, and we were watching the mullahs like nobody's business. You see, for instance, we would never, in our time, allow a recruit to wear a beard, and mullahs inevitably wear beards. And we always fought tooth and nail to stop that. And so, luckily, of course, we were never short of recruits, and therefore we could pick and choose. But there, as an example, we call them religious leaders, but we would never call them mullahs. Mullahs was a thing that the Indian Army didn't like at all. I mean, the rank and file troops rather looked down on mullahs.
What was the significance of not allowing them to have beards?
Well, because the whole trouble is that if they get themselves into a position where they imagine they are cut above the rest, that they are cut above any instruction that they might get from an officer, you listen to what a mullah says, but not what an officer says. This is the sort of danger you're up against. You see, it's an exactly the same idea as another point, and that is that you are not allowed, and it's very strict this, not allowed to speak English to any sepoy. The only people who were allowed to speak English to were a clerk, for obvious reasons. Yeah, all the ledgers and all the rest of it had to be kept. Clerks were allowed to speak English, and occasionally, and not very many of them, were rather bright NCOs who have a prospect of becoming an officer in the future, but he'd have to be very bright. And he, at times, would be encouraged to speak English in order to give him practice. But for the rest, you were on pain of death. You were not to try and speak to English. You jolly well learned the language yourself. Now, there's a very sound reason for that, which is brought out, and that is this, that if you allow people to try and speak English to a sepoy and give him an order in English, and the sepoy doesn't like to pretend he doesn't understand what you're saying, if anything goes wrong, you mustn't be in a position to say it was a sepoy's fault. You see, it isn't. It's your fault because you couldn't speak his language. And it's always struck me as being very sound then.
Did you ever have any religious leaders trying to bring untoward influence on the troops?
No, Never. And if you did, you'd get rid of them quickly. And you're empowered to do that. Very occasionally, I remember years when I first joined, I think there was just one. And he just disappeared. He faded away. I don't know what happened to him. I'm not suggesting he was murdered. He just left the battalion and went home, and that was the end of that. This would be backed up by army headquarters in India, too.
What exactly was he trying to do?
Well, you might say turn it into the sort of mullah business, which we've discussed already. In other words, that the religious influence was to be much stronger than any influence or any instructions he got from an army officer.
Did the troops worship on a Friday?
Oh, yes. Very definitely. Oh, yes. And also the thing you've got to watch, you have Ramzan, as you know, Ramadan, as they call it. And as you know, Ramadan is for the whole month, they're not allowed to eat or drink after dawn and so on. Now, you did try and reduce the amount of training and that sort of thing during that time, because it does put a strain on, particularly if you're in a station such as Multan, which is very, very hot, and you're not allowed to drink from dawn to dusk. Nothing must pass your lips, let alone food. It was the liquids the trouble. Then you try and reduce the pressure on them and so on. But I always remember that the battalion, the first aid, had to move from India to Hong Kong right in the middle of Ramzan. Now, you couldn't have that situation on a crowded troop ship. And it had to be organized through the highest religious leaders in army headquarters and all the rest of it, that all right, they'd forego Ramzan while they're on their journey, but they'd have to start immediately they got to Hong Kong. That's the way it sort of... But that was very unusual.
So, say you had a Muslim sepoy who was cool towards his own religion. Would that have been welcomed?
Well, if you say cool to the extent that he's seen drinking alcohol and all the rest of it, you would leave that to your... This is where your viceroy's commissioned officers come in. And the great chap, of course, in Invitown, which they don't like now after partition, but we liked, of course, was a chap called the Subedar Major. And the Subedar Major was a very specially selected... Well, VCO, senior VCO, and he was the one who watched that sort of thing. He was the one who would tell the CO, or in other words, that there is going to be a problem for all sorts of reasons down in A Company, B Company, or C Company, which you might say, well, why didn't the British officer know that? Well, he probably did, but this Subedar Major, being one of them,